This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
News, weather, traffic, money, politics, big interviews, and bold opinions. It's what's happening right now. This is Mornings with Simi.
The Trans-Canada Trail is 27,000 kilometers long. It stretches across the country, connects the Atlantic, the Arctic, and the Pacific Oceans. And Deanne Whelan has just become the first person to complete it, or is very close to that point. And she's paddling, cycling, and walking her way along the trail. And to finish, she's going to paddle into Victoria. So we thought we'd catch up to her right now and find out where she is. Deanne, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Oh, thank you, Simi. Thank you.
Where are you?
I am sitting on Sydney Island. I'm trying not to speak too loudly because I'm sitting right on the edge of the ocean next to my canoe, and there's lots of people still sleeping in tents. but beautiful Sydney Island. I'm just sat here and watched the sunrise and quickly inhaled the coffee so that you would be speaking to Dee and not Sasquatch this morning, because, you know, after 6 years out here.
I'm sorry. Did you say how long has this taken you?
6 years.
What? That's crazy.
I know. I left July 1st, 2015 from St. John's, Newfoundland. And I never could have imagined it would have taken 6 years for me. But, you know, on day 10 of the journey, right at the very beginning, I woke up one morning and I had the schedule, you know. And I looked at the schedule and I'm like, you have not even accomplished day one yet. So you're going to need. So I just burned the schedule because I realized, you know, that wasn't going to be happening. And I just surrendered to the journey at that point. And I like to tease everybody and say that's the day I dropped my rabbit suit for my turtle shell on this journey. But really, I realized that not everything of value can be measured numerically, right? Like,
right.
I left after turning 50, and like, how fast or how long or how strong, like, none of that really matters to me anymore. It was more like that race kind of feels manic, and I just remembered the old tale of the rabbit and the turtle, and I'm like, well, the rabbit, you know, burns itself out, and the turtle completes the journey, so I knew I needed to heed that wisdom if I was going to survive and complete this epic journey, and it's about the most meaningful way, not the most fastest way.
I love that. I do. So, Deanne, why? Like, where did this idea come from? Why are you so committed to it?
Well, it's a great question to me. I mean, how do we really understand our passions, right? I mean, look, you get up at 4 o'clock in the morning to do your job every day. We are what we're willing to suffer for, I guess, you know. But I like to say it's a story with many beginnings. And I'd have to say my mother was actually the one who planted this seed. She made a donation to the trail in the early 1990s and said it was something she'd love to do. And then 20 years later, that seed sprouted, I guess. I'd already filmed on Mount Everest, so I'd been to the world's highest mountain. And I filmed up on the northwest coast of Ellesmere Island, so one of the most northern coastlines in the world. So I thought, well, the longest trail in the world didn't seem like a pretty natural fit. But as a storyteller, too, I just really thought that the trail is this perfect metaphor for this story, which is I was looking for an umbilical cord that connects us all, you know, for all our differences. What is it that we share? And, of course, it's the land and the water.
So you decided to do this. There must have been some times along the way, though, in the last 6 years that you thought, you know what, this was a mistake. I shouldn't be doing this. Like, what were the hard parts here?
Well, to be honest with you, Cindy, I never actually felt like I would want to quit because of the way I traveled. You know, if I was tired, I stopped. I rested a day or a week or whatever I needed. Like, I knew that I had to sustain self-care, right? And I also took days off to film and write and connect and work with other artists. And on a journey this long, home just becomes something that you carry within yourself, you know, and you won't make it on a schedule because you can't control Mother Nature anyway. So, yeah, I just there was never really a question of quitting because it was just a question of just like giving myself what I needed and finding the resolve to just continue on, you know.
What were the highlights for you? Like, were there moments when you thought, oh, I'm so lucky to be doing this. I'm so glad I did this.
Almost every day, really. I mean, You know, just it's very grounding to be out in nature for this long. At first, of course, there was fear and apprehension because it was the unknown. And I mean, to be honest with you, before I even left, I'd never really had done more than one night alone out in like camping or anything like that, you know, and I'd never paddled alone before. And now I've paddled 10,000 kilometers. So, yeah, a lot of it was just overcoming personal fear. And a lot of that just happens from doing it. And then your fear is not substantiated. You know, the big bear didn't come in the middle of the night and steal me out of my tent. And I haven't drowned or whatever the apprehensions were. They really, you know, faded away with just doing it. And, I feel really connected out here. I thought I'd be really alone, but there's something ancient in our DNA that wakes up once you've been out here for a long time, you know?
What was your favorite, what was your favorite spot that you went to? Like, I'm just looking at a map of the Trans-Canada Trail and boy, oh boy, I mean, you've been going places. You went all the way up to the Arctic Ocean there. So what was your favorite spot?
I like to say everywhere I found human kindness, that's for sure. And that was right across this country from day one in St. John's right through to today. Like, you know, so somebody running over and saying, oh, here's a coffee for your interview. You know, I mean, human kindness is been the currency of this journey. And I would have to say, as far as the trails go, like in all honesty, the water trails have been my favorite because they're the most ancient. And there's just something like that's one thing I'll carry away from this journey is I know I'll be doing a lot more long distance canoe trips. I just absolutely fell in love with canoeing.
Oh, you're going to miss this though, aren't you, Deanne? Like, this is what you've been doing for 6 years. So when are you going to reach Victoria? And then what do you do the day after?
That's a great question, Simi. I'm going to reach Victoria for the first time in 6 years. I actually have a date that I'm aiming for, and that's August 1st, which is this Sunday. I'm going to try to land just next to Clover, I think it's called Clover Point, in Beacon Hill, and that's where Mile Zero is for the Trans-Canada Trail. And I'm going to land on the beach there around 11 a.m., I hope, and then be able to walk the last couple hundred meters with my mom and my dad and my family and friends and anyone else who cares to join us, really. It's just about, at that point, reconnecting and sharing and being with family again, you know? I mean, that's certainly one of the big costs of going on these expeditions and journeys is you know, there's always things you have to leave behind. And the only thing that really matters are the people that we love at the end of the day. And so I'm really looking forward to reconnecting on that level with people that I love. But I'm also really, really excited to me because I'm a filmmaker. And my inspiration to come out here was to make another film and also have a personal journey, you know. And so now it's an exciting time of, like, applying for grants and finding the funds to complete this documentary and write a book, and that'll probably take me the next 2 years of my life. So, well, I'll get to relive every day of it.
I look forward to reading and watching that for sure, Deanne. Listen, best of luck.
Thank you, Simi. Have a great day.
You too. She's going to have a beautiful day. It's Deanne Whelan, an award-winning filmmaker, multimedia artist who is just about to become the first person to complete the Trans-Canada Trail. Take a look at this map online and you'll see what a huge accomplishment this is by Deanne. 27,000 kilometers across the country connects the Atlantic, the Arctic, the Pacific Oceans. And on Sunday, she will paddle into Victoria and she will finish that 6-year journey.
This is Mornings with Simi.
Are you worried about the fourth wave of COVID-19? Well, that's the question asked in a new poll of Canadians right across the country. And without a doubt, I think we can say the answer is yes, Canadians are worried. Daryl Bricker from Ipsos Public Affairs joins us now with more on this. Good morning, Daryl.
Good morning, Simi.
So how worried are we?
We're very worried. 81% of us say that they're worried about variants affecting Canada, and they also see this potentially building up into a fourth wave. So 69% of us think that might happen.
Now, is this like in every province? Was it right across the country?
Yeah, it's pretty high everywhere. So what we're talking about here is a sort of degrees of difference, but not degrees in terms of difference in terms of overall opinion. We're all kind of worried, but disproportionately worried in places like Atlantic Canada that had a bit of an easier go during the previous round of COVID, although more recently it's been a bit more difficult, and Ontario. The least concerned about it at the moment is Quebec, but this is something that we've seen throughout the pandemic, where they seem to be more positive on many elements of the disease.
Right, because you also asked, I know, you asked about the consensus on a new normal. Like, is this the new normal? And what do people have to say about that?
Well, about 67% of us say we should learn to live with COVID. It is becoming a bit of a new normal. And, you know, other polls that we've done show that people keep pushing out the date for when all of this is going to end. And there is, I think, a growing belief that this is just something that we're going to be having to manage for the longer term.
Right. But that was different depending on which province you lived in, wasn't it?
Yeah, again, Quebec is the province that stands out as having a bit of a different opinion on this. But places like Alberta, for example, less interested in things like shutdowns and more of a libertarian type of event. And in places like Quebec, where they think they've had a different experience with this, not quite as high.
Interesting, though. So it also just kind of reflects how their governments in those provinces are kind of treating the situation.
Yeah, it is one of those things where we tend to get our signals about what's going to happen from the external world. But when it comes to what's actually happening in your life, you get it from what's happening around you, which means your provincial governments, your municipal governments, anybody that's right. close to you. The federal government is seen as having primary responsibility for something like vaccines, you know, accessing vaccines, which was a bigger issue a couple of months ago. But yeah, it tends to become, once you get into managing the issue, more of a local set of concerns.
Right. And I know a lot of areas are talking again about restrictions here in BC for the first time ever. We're having regional restrictions put in place for areas around Kelowna. How did the people that you ask feel about the idea of more kind of lockdown measures or restrictions?
Well, they certainly don't like them. That's something that we've been seeing consistently through the pandemic. But they're prepared to contemplate them. In fact, 69% of us say that they would support more lockdowns if it's necessary to stop a fourth wave.
Really? And so it must have been different by province, though.
Again, you know, you get into the situation where Alberta, libertarian, not so interested in it. Quebec, they don't really necessarily feel that they need it. British Columbia and places like British Columbia and in Ontario, definitely higher levels of support for things like lockdowns.
Isn't that so interesting? Like, Daryl, have you seen that change in the time of the pandemic? You've been asking people about these issues?
The reason I can say it so easily is because the pattern's pretty well established. I would say, though, that on the issue of lockdowns, 69% is lower than what we would be seeing, say, for example, 6 months ago, where support for lockdowns would be higher. So I think that we're moving into a phase now in which people are more likely to be contemplating the idea of figuring out more targeted ways of dealing with this and contemplating living with COVID for the longer term, which means that you can't lock down people indefinitely.
And do you think that's also the impact of vaccines?
Yeah, definitely. 62% of us say that vaccines are going to help with us with this. So, you know, we have a long conversations in this country about vaccine hesitancy. There's a difference between vaccine denial and people just having some concerns. And most of what we're dealing with in terms of vaccine hesitancy is people with concerns. So the longer that this goes on, the more that people see that the way out of it is going to be vaccination, the more likely you're going to pick up those people who are merely hesitant rather than deniers.
Right, because you did ask people about that too, right? About how they feel about the vaccines kind of fixing the situation.
Yeah, and very high support for that. 69% of the populations, 62% of the populations, saying that it's going to help. But this is research that we've seen all over the world, and you know, particularly in Canada, on the issue of vaccine hesitancy. So if you think that there's a big population of vaccine deniers in Canada, it's probably around 5%. It's not really high. It's a last mile type of issue. The bigger issue that we're dealing with right now is just getting vaccines to people who are a bit concerned.
So interesting. Daryl, thank you.
Always a pleasure, Simi.
This is Mornings with Simi.
It's been a rough week, you could say, for the central Okanagan interior part of our province. COVID-19 cases there are continuing to climb. You've got wildfire problems and the smoke choking other areas, and now hotter temperatures expected over the next couple of days. It is not a great situation there. So we heard yesterday that Provincial Health Officer Dr. Bonnie Henry and Health Minister Adrian Dix and the Interior Health Interim Chief Medical Health Officer have declared an outbreak for the Central Okanagan region. So this includes Kelowna, West Kelowna, West Bank First Nation, Peachland, Lake Country, and some other electoral areas in there. And so that means there's going to be regional restrictions. That's the first time we've done something like this during the pandemic. But Dr. Henry said these are needed. It's been quite an impact on businesses as well. So joining us now to talk about all of this is Kelowna Mayor Colin Bazran. Colin, thank you very much for being here.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
What have the last couple of days been like?
The last couple of weeks have been very challenging for our community. Probably followed, of course, the crane collapse here that killed five people,
right.
The wildfires, the COVID case increases. It's been challenging, but Kelowna residents and Okanagan residents continue to rise above it and do the best we can to get through it.
And I understand that a lot of businesses were, you know, thinking they had to close anyway. They were doing it on their own voluntarily because of COVID-19 cases.
Yeah, so a lot of business, some hospitality businesses were closing due to the fact that some of their staff had tested positive, so doing the right thing and then closing down and doing all the necessary things needed in order to reopen whenever it's appropriate to do that. So we were seeing that, and then, it made sense given the rising case count that this was going to happen. It's been tough on businesses for sure. And these new regional restrictions are certainly disappointing, but it's the right thing to do given what's happening with the cases. I think probably the biggest frustration, though, is that we continue to see the large majority of those cases be people who are unvaccinated. And that, I think, is probably the most frustrating part.
Yeah, how is the city getting involved in that? I understand there's also going to be kind of a campaign wrapping up to get the message out on that front.
Yeah, so we'll do whatever we can to get the message out, social media channels, myself and others doing media interviews. We're working with Interior Health on locations for, pop-up vaccination clinics and things like that. So certainly we play a part, but of course, as you know, this is driven by the Ministry of Health and our local health authority. But we're continuing to cooperate with them wherever we can and help get the word out and get people, vaccinated. That's the quickest and easiest, best way we're going to get through this is for people to do the right thing and do that.
Did you think that these regional restrictions were necessary at this point?
That's tough to say. I'm not a medical health expert, but, I appreciate the work that's being done. And I think given the climbing case count, it's probably needed. And I also think that it's a good thing for us to be discouraging people as painful as it is, because I love when people come visit my city. It's the appropriate thing to say at this point that if you're not vaccinated, please don't come to Kelowna and the Okanagan.
What has the tourist situation been like over the last month?
It's been crazy busy. A lot of people want to come to the Okanagan, rightfully. It's the reason why we live here. We love it. But tourism has been very busy. Hotel rooms are booked. Hospitality establishments have been full. And so we continue to be the hot spot that people want to visit throughout the country. And rightfully so. But it's like I say, it's never easy to have to tell people now, unless you're vaccinated, please stay away. But it's the right thing to do right now.
All right. What about that indoor mask mandate? Now they're saying indoor public places, you have to put that mask back on in the Kelowna area there. Is that something you're going to be watching out for? Do you think people will listen?
I think people will listen. It's the right thing to do. And, previously when we had the mask mandate, the majority of residents followed it. I don't think it'll be a problem. Putting them back on, as frustrating as it is. And the good news is that, most, if all, businesses still get to keep operating. So it could be a lot worse. And I guess that's my warning, too, is that, again, if people don't get vaccinated, this is step one of rolling back of the opening. And there could be more restrictions on the way if people don't adhere to what's being asked of us right now. And that's a scary thought. So I don't want to see further restrictions, and hopefully we can avoid them.
Mayor Bazran, why do you think it is that the vaccination rates are a little bit lower in that area?
That's a good question, and I don't really have a good answer for that. Keeping in mind, too, not to put the onus on people who have visited from elsewhere, because, again, the Kelowna residents play a part in this, too. But I think that we've had people visit here who have been unvaccinated, and that's part of it, the issue as well. But I can't explain why there are people in our community choosing not to. Again, we'll continue to do what we can to show them that it's the right thing to do.
Right. Do you think that's what it was? Or was it just like, you know, things got really busy there, I think really quickly when restrictions got lifted and perhaps like younger people just were too busy?
You know, it's a combination of many things. I can't point to any one particular reason why the case count climbed in our city. Part of it certainly is how many people were visiting here. Like I say, at the end of the day, people need to do the right thing, though, and go and get their shots.
So how long will these new restrictions be in place for?
Well, it appears at this point it's going to be 2 weeks. And then, of course, things will be reassessed and then we'll see where things go from there. But I'm hoping it's only 2 weeks. But I think we've seen when other orders have been put in place that oftentimes 2 weeks is not enough. But I'm really hoping in this particular instance it is. This is the first time we've seen regional restrictions put in place like this, and I hope it's the last time.
How's the wildfire situation? What's the smoke like in Kelowna?
The smoke the last 2 or 3 days has been pretty thick. I believe the weather forecast calls for it to clear out a bit today and starting tomorrow. It's pretty thick. Fortunately, in Kelowna itself, there are no fires in the immediate area, which is good. So it's smoke mostly from fires elsewhere burning around us. But it's part of a really challenging couple of weeks that we've had here in the Okanagan. But it doesn't seem to be deterring people from visiting here.
Right. But what is your message then for tourists or potential tourists at this time?
So the message is, if you're not vaccinated, unfortunately, you're not welcome here. And that is the message, and I hope that people will adhere to that. I know some won't, and that will be frustrating, but hopefully then they won't add to our case count. But yeah, please, and it pains me to do this because I want people to come and visit and experience Kelowna. If you don't have your shots, don't come.
All right. Thank you very much for your time this morning, and best of luck.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
That's Colin Bassarin, who's the mayor of Kelowna, talking about a challenging time for that area. The central Okanagan had new restrictions imposed yesterday by health officials. That's the first time that we have seen regional restrictions imposed. So what do those restrictions include? Well, mask mandate for indoor public places. That's for anybody older than the age of 12. They want people to organize events outdoors rather than indoors if possible. And restaurants are going backwards a step to step 3, which means they've reduced the maximum capacity of indoor venues. And they said bars, restaurants, and nightclubs must have COVID-19 safety plans in place. They're allowing them to stay open, nightclubs in particular, allowing them to stay open. They're allowing liquor service to remain at normal hours, but they once again want people to stop socializing between tables. They're reducing the second dose interval of vaccinations to 4 weeks because they want to get people vaccinated quicker. So that'll be a big one. And as we heard the mayor just say there, they're also discouraging non-essential travel to the region by people who are not yet fully vaccinated. And that's a big one. Like if you were planning to go and you haven't got that second shot, they're saying, listen, we'd love to have you, but get your second shot before you come and visit, or get a shot in particular before you come and visit.
This is Mornings with Simi.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Well, BC finds itself in a bit of an unusual situation, a deficit of more than $5 billion. And everyone looks at it and thinks, wow, not bad. Could have been a lot worse. Well, the financial update shows that the deficit is billions of dollars less than was expected. So what happened? Let's get a breakdown of our financial picture. Joining us now is Selena Robinson, BC's finance minister. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Good morning, Simi. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. So where did we do well here? Like what changed with our financial picture?
Well, I think what really changed, frankly, is that British Columbia did the right thing. They followed the health guidance that Dr. Bonnie Henry provided for us. They got vaccinated, and it really allowed us to move forward. To restart our recovery plan in a timely way, and to get back to a more normal life. And that just really meant that more people were working. We've recovered all of our jobs that were lost, and we have a more normal interaction, and that's been good for the economy.
And did that show in certain aspects of revenue?
Certainly, for sure. We certainly saw more tax revenue come in than we expected because people were working. They were able to pay their taxes. We found that certainly the forestry sector was very robust, and that was not expected. And the other thing that I think is really important to acknowledge is ICBC turnaround. That was pretty significant. Some said perhaps that it couldn't be done, and we did it, and it's now in the black. And we even gave, I think it's $950 million back in COVID savings back to drivers. So there were lots of positives that we were able to see on the economic front because people did the right thing.
Right. I think you should also be prepared that now that ICBC is doing well, people are going to start to say, well, that money's going to stay with ICBC, right?
It is. We changed the law. We're very different from the former government. The BC Liberals used that money for other things, and we've committed that it stays for drivers. It's about making sure that people get the care that they need when they need it and keeping rates low for drivers.
Okay, so let's talk about the other areas then that did improve. The property transfer tax did better than expected as well.
It did. We certainly saw the activity in the housing market that wasn't anticipated. And that was, as a result of COVID, we certainly saw people looking to change their living situations, working from home. They found that they could, A, work from home. They didn't need to be close to their work. And B, that they needed more space. So we certainly, no one was predicting that. And certainly with low interest rates, too, that added that to that activity level. What we're seeing now is that is leveling off, and the experts are predicting to see more moderation in that market in the year ahead. So we're certainly continuing to keep an eye on how the housing market is operating throughout British Columbia.
Right. So, okay. So about $5 billion in deficit, but that's still a gap that needs to be closed. How are we going to do that?
That's an excellent question. And when we delivered our budget in April, the current budget year that we're in, we're really clear with British Columbians that this pandemic has impacted, every single government around the world. It's a global phenomenon, and that we were on solid fiscal ground as British Columbians because we have had, a series of balanced budgets for quite some time. And we have a very resilient economic base. We have a diversity in our economy, and the economists look to us around and certainly have recognized that this diversified economy for our province really makes a difference and allows us to keep on even keel. And the other thing that we said back in April, because this is unprecedented and we've never been here before, understanding sort of, how things are going to come back, when they're going to come back. We certainly see the tourism sector, service sectors, still very much impacted by COVID. So understanding which sectors of our economy continue to need help is important. And also how, while we've started recovery, it's not a full recovery just yet. So we've committed that with the next budget 2022, we will have a plan to get back to balance, recognizing it is going to take some time. This has been, certainly a challenge for all of us. But we also needed and still need to make sure that we're there for people. That's what everyone needed. I think people are grateful mm-hmm. that we were able to respond and get vaccines into arms as quickly as we have been. And really, at the end of the day, I think British Columbians were the ones who need to be acknowledged and thanked for doing the right thing so that we could keep things as steady as we can.
Right. Are you concerned, though, about certain areas? Like you mentioned, okay, part of the revenue did well from property transfer tax because of how the market performed last year, but that market is leveling out now, so we can't expect that year after year mm-hmm. to happen. So are there challenges that you are concerned about for the next couple of years?
Well, I'm the finance minister. I'm always concerned about, you know, making sure that we can continue to provide the services that people count on, and so that they can thrive. I mean, that is, you know, is our role as government, is to support people, to support businesses, to support communities, so that people can have, you know, a good life, a life where they can take care of their families, you know, a life where they can live with dignity, age with grace and with dignity. That's, I think, what we all want. And we've certainly seen through the pandemic how important many of these things are around, you know, how to invest in people and in families. So that's why, for example, our childcare plan is part of our economic recovery plan. That's why we're investing in childcare, because we know that when people can work, they can take care of, we can take care of each other. And so childcare, you know, became, and I'm so grateful that we've had this childcare plan that we started rolling out a number of years ago, because it was critical to getting through COVID.
Right.
So these are all the things that are continually imbalanced, and we're going to keep monitoring and make sure that British Columbians can have their needs met so that they can take care of their family.
Is any kind of new revenue generation ideas on the table?
You know what, at this point, there's lots of unknowns still. Like, you know, we just saw just doing these public accounts. You know, the fact that it's $2.7 billion lower than projected, the deficit, sort of tells us that there's still lots of unknowns. And so as we see more and more strength back in the economy, which, you know, and more activity happening in a more normal, well, say, in a more normal context, we'll have a better sense of how to best move forward and address the deficit. And that will be in February.
All right. Thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you for having me. Have a good one. Bye-bye.
You too. That's Selena Robinson, BC's finance minister, talking about the state of BC's books. Better than expected, but still a gap that needs to be closed.
This is Mornings with Simi.
COVID-19 is not the only public health crisis and emergency that we have in this province. For years, even before the pandemic came along, we were dealing with the opioid overdose crisis. And as much as we talk about it and as much as we try different things, we're still talking about people dying from this. The latest update from the BC Coroner's Drug Toxicity Report shows that at least five people were dying every day due to the ongoing opioid crisis. We've talked about safe supply. What else should we be doing at this point to try to finally put a dent in this? Well, joining us now is Mark Tyndall, professor in the School of Population and Public Health at UBC. Thanks for joining us this morning.
My pleasure, Simi.
Does this frustrate you when you think about it? Like, everything else gets so much attention. Why don't we talk more about the opioid overdose crisis?
It is extremely frustrating for, you know, people dealing with this every day and people at risk. So it, yeah, as you mentioned, it's been going on for about 6 years. When we first noticed a large increase in the number of people dying, it was, I was the head of the BC Center for Disease Control at that time. And if you had told me 6 years later we'd still be dealing with these numbers, I wouldn't have believed you.
We are. No kidding. Has anything improved during that time?
Well, I think we've got into this pattern of incremental little things. So, you know, the reality is that the risk of overdosing today is higher than it was in 2016. The drugs are more toxic and more difficult to come by, and people are putting themselves at risk with every use. So the numbers that we get reported by the coroner's office, which are, you know, somewhere between 160 and 200 deaths per month, is really just a tip of the iceberg. For everybody that dies, there's probably 20 people who technically overdosed and didn't die. So it's just a massive problem. So I think the ideas have been put forward. You know, we need you know, better housing and mental health supports and more recovery beds and the safe supply and all these things. And you could the government could point to individual little programs that have been implemented, but we really don't have a plan. And all these little incremental steps have really not improved the odds of people using. Yeah.
So, you know, they might have worked if we were still dealing with the situation from 6 years ago.
Well, we never have really have a plan. There's nobody there's no targets. There's nobody that's really accountable. The government public health officials can get up there every month and say that they're really sorry that this is continuing and this is a tragedy. But there's, you know, it happens the following month and, well, just the same thing all over again. And there's really no response.
That's a good point, though, about, no targets. Because if you really want to accomplish something, especially with government, you set targets, right? And with this, we just keep saying, well, we hope this works or we're going to try this.
Yeah, and really, there's no chance that these things are going to work in the scale that they've been happening. So, you know, just this week, we have the Deputy Prime Minister here announcing a housing start. Well, that's 48 units. It's a great photo op, but it's just not going to make a dent in the housing issue. And we have safe supply guidelines now that have been rolled out, but there's no real implementation plan or operational plan. So guidelines are fairly useless unless there's a plan to actually implement and support this. And so, we haven't been able to do that.
So what would it take, do you think, at this point?
Well, I do think it would. We need targets and a plan, and we need a massive investment in this. I mean, it's arguably a very difficult problem. We're dealing with a lot of people who have been left behind by society for the most part, and it's not going to improve for them if somebody gives them a prescription for Dilaudid. I mean, it's very. We need, real investment in this. And, I spend a lot of time walking around the downtown east side, which is, often the focus of this. And the streets are lined with people that have nowhere to go and are just openly using drugs and running away from police. And this has been this situation for decades, and that really has to change.
You know, all the times that we've talked about this on the show, Dr. Tindall, I'm always struck by somebody who once said that, when somebody has a heart attack or a stroke in a hospital, that puts them into the continuum of care, right? We don't just let them walk out of the hospital after having a heart attack and not have any follow-up or talk to them or help them change their diet or anything like that. Why don't we do that with somebody who shows up with an overdose?
Yeah, well, we're really just trying to keep do the best just to keep people alive for that moment. And we send ambulances and paramedic teams out there, and we've armed a lot of the community members with naloxone, and then our job's done. You know, we've reversed that overdose and we're on to the next one. So we really don't have a plan. And unfortunately, we also need to adjust our plan. So that follow-up needs to be tailored to that person's needs and what they're likely to do. So I've been involved clinically for a long time. People don't show up for their follow-up appointments. Well, it's because they don't trust the medical system. It's never done anything for them. And so we really need to, alter our approach and make our programs attractive to people who we want to engage.
Absolutely. Dr. Tindall, thank you for your time.
Okay, my pleasure.
Appreciate that. Dr. Mark Tindall is a professor in the School of Population and Public Health, talking about our other public health crisis, and that would be the opioid overdose crisis.
This is Mornings with Simi.
Well, there's a lot of talk about what's going to happen in September, right? September 7th, I think, is the day that is marked as the last step in our reopening plan, which is when pretty much everything goes back to normal. Coincides with heading back to school, not just for K-12, but also for post-secondary students. So what can those students, professors, and instructors expect with that return to in-person classes in September? To talk more about that, we're joined now by Brent Calvert, who's the president of the BC Federation of Post-Secondary Educators. Brent, thank you for being here.
Good morning, Simi. Happy Thursday.
Oh, happy Thursday to you. We're almost there, Brent. We're almost there. It's almost Friday. What do you know at this point about the plans for what like a classroom, a lecture hall is going to look like in September?
What we know right now, I think the context is really important, is that we've transitioned off of the public health office direction and what was publicized institutional safety plans to what's called a communicable disease prevention plan. That came into effect on July 5th, and that's carrying us through to September 7th, as you described in the intro. We do know coming to campus that we have largely a return to in-person learning taking place, and in concert with that, we know that institutions right now are working with their joint occupational health and safety committees and things to frame up what that looks like at each institution, because there's a high degree of variability right across the province.
And what do you mean? Like, what would that variability entail?
Well, depending on the type of courses and classes, right now there's a mix. Primarily in-person classes is what is being presented to people. There are also options for online classes or what they call hybrid or flex classes, which feature a mix of in-person and online.
Okay, so does every institution have to decide what will work for them?
Yeah, it's broken down depending on the department, the type of course, the level of hands-on instruction would certainly be a factor within that. So it's a real different landscape now, and it's the goal, I think, is to get as much of the traditional in-learning type of classes put in place. And along with that, of course, you've got concerns about vaccination rates. Are people doubly vaccinated? Are masks mandatory? And none of these things have been settled yet.
Is that still in the process? Because I know that the UBC Student Society came out and said they want to see all of that in place.
Yeah, it's just starting to break. I think we're following on the heels of what's taking place in healthcare right now, where you've got different groups coming forward and saying, the opportunities are ripe on a campus in an in-person learning environment for close proximity and some of the things we know that are problematic with COVID-19. And in the absence of policies, and the direction that we follow comes through the public health office, and I think institutions are going to be feeling the pressure from different stakeholder groups about what's being done, what's going to be put in place. The overarching piece that we're looking at is, I know everyone wants to feel safe and secure in that learning environment.
Right. So what will be the options, do you think, Brent, then, for, hybrid classes? I think some students probably very much enjoyed having to be able to do those classes from home.
Yeah. And I think that's what we're going to see, is there's going to be a level of personal discretion in this, where students may say, I feel most comfortable in that environment and working that way. And I think faculty, too, right? Our faculty and staff are part of the mix here, as well as administrators at campuses. And it's a tricky situation, and we don't have a lot of time left before September 7th is going to be upon us.
Do you think that we will see, full capacity classes, or will there be some physical distancing?
The direction that we've received so far in in-person classes is that there are no restrictions. So if you're talking about a 300-person lecture hall, it can be used to capacity. Issues have been raised about concerns around ventilation systems and things like that, and all the consultations have said those are fine and not a contributory factor. And so as far as we know, as of this date, that is the plan, is there would be no restrictions on class sizes that way.
Yeah, how does that make you feel, though?
I think that's part of what's raising the concerns right now is, as you get closer towards that date, it's going to get more and more real for all parties involved. And, if the student societies are coming forward with requests for confirmation or more details about how the safety is going to be ensured, I can expect it's going to come from other stakeholder groups as well.
Right. So obviously, instructors would be a stakeholder group. So are you being consulted on this?
We have a number of associations that are starting to raise the concern. They're looking at the environment. I think, listening to the preface, hearing about what's taken place in Tokyo and what's happening in Okanagan are going to continue to spike those fears, right? As the Delta variant comes in, people are going to be more and more concerned. And I think that's going to lead to some tough discussions around, will masks be required, at a minimum? Will proof of vaccination be required? It's hard to say right now how that's going to go. I can certainly confirm that it is a growing concern, though.
I wonder, will it be dependent on where perhaps the post-secondary institution is, right? We saw in the Central Okanagan, they're putting in place regional restrictions. Are we going to have to follow along with that?
I think that's a very interesting observation. It could be a contributory factor. Of course, our thinking to date has been just looking at the province as a whole, but I'm sure that we're going to find there's going to be regional differences if the COVID, Delta variant is continuing to spike in BC.
Right. So we're getting into August, though, here, Brent. So when is all of this going to be nailed down? Because I know students would like to have some answers. I'm sure instructors would, too. Some answers about this.
Yeah. I think we're, like I said, we're probably on the heels of what's taking place in the healthcare component. People are asking. I mean, there's a real date with not only post-secondary, but K-12. And I think the pressure is going to continue to build where people are asking, what are we going to do to put in place? And I would think, you know, the practical, easy steps are looking at requiring masks, right, to ensure safety. I'm not sure if we have the time or the runway or the legal ability to get into the proof of vaccinations and those kind of things as well in the short period of time that we've got.
We'll see what happens. Brent, thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks, Jimmy.